When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I want to ask you guys, what are your street names?
Street names. I mean, I have like a nickname that my family gave me when I was a kid, but I'm not cool enough for a street name.
Jophie.
Jophie. So you guys aren't into the idea of something that sounds really intimidating and crazy then, huh?
Like, I think I would be intimidating and crazy.
Yeah, I think I would be like Pete the Anvil or something like that, you know?
All right.
I mean, you are Pete the Pepper.
Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily... I mean, I guess a pepper can be pretty menacing at times.
Spicy. Pete the Ghost Reaper.
Yeah, I think it's funny that they kind of bring this up in the beginning. You know, he's talking to Skinny Pete there, speaking of Pete. And he says, you know, you got robbed by a guy named Spooge, you know, not Diesel or whatever.
Mad Dog.
And then, yeah, Mad Dog. And then, you know, he comes back later. And when he introduces himself, he introduces himself as Diesel. So it's kind of funny the way that, you present yourself, you know, the way you present yourself and the way that you see yourself. And then the obvious contrast here we have with how Jesse carries himself, you know, in the situation with the neglected kid there.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Honey, you blocking the mailbox.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Sorry.
Like it's going to be a nice day, huh?
Oh, yeah. High 70s.
You have a great day.
Right on, you too.
All right, this is Growth Decay Transformation, a Breaking Bad rewatch podcast. I'm Pete.
And I'm Courtney.
And today we're talking about Season 2, Episode 6, Peekaboo. And it seems like every time we have an episode with Gretchen, or I guess the Schwartzes, and, you know, more generally, one of the Bald Move guys shows up. And today we're joined by Aaron. So how's it going?
It's going pretty good. I saw the Schwartz symbol in the air, the Schwartz signal go out, and I had to pick up the red phone and make a call to Pete.
Yeah. So we're gonna go through the episode, and if you could help us out, Courtney, can you give us a synopsis of what happened?
Yeah, sure. So in this one, Walt finally goes back to work, and while he is out back at school for his first day, Gretchen calls the house to check in. Skyler thanks her for paying for Walt's treatment, and Gretchen, who is obviously confused by this, decides to stop by the White House. Okay, so Walton Jr. arrive home from school to find Gretchen's Bentley in the driveway. Inside, Flint thanks her for her help, and much to Walt's surprise, she says, "You're welcome." She then hurries off, and Walt follows her out and asks her not to do or say anything. They then meet at a restaurant where he apologizes but refuses to tell her why he lied to his family about her and Elliot paying for his treatment. They begin to argue about their past, and it's clear that Walt feels like the Schwartzes stole his life's work, while Gretchen argues that it was Walt who left her, and we get some more insight into their backstory, that they were a couple at some point, and they were at her parents' house or her family's house on a 4th of July weekend. And she says, "I feel sorry for you," and Walt replies that with an ice-cold fuck you on the uncensored version of the episode anyway, which prompts her to leave. Meanwhile, Jesse gets Spooge's address from Skinny Pete and goes over to the house to retrieve the crystal that they stole. After he breaks in, he finds a little kid alone in the house who he bonds with as he waits for them to come back. When the Spooges do arrive home, they're arguing about losing the crystal, and Jesse holds a gun on them and demands that they turn over the drugs they stole. When they tell Jesse that Mrs. Spooge, or Skank, lost the drugs, Jesse demands that they pay him. So Spooge then takes Jesse into the backyard where he shows him an ATM that he lifted, and then they try to break it open. While Jesse is distracted, he gets hit over the head and they take his gun. When he finally comes to, Spooge is working underneath the ATM machine, like the way it reminds me of like the way a mechanic, you know, gets on his back and is underneath a car. And he's arguing with his wife and he keeps calling her a skank. And that is clearly a mistake because then she tips the ATM machine over onto his head. So
I ain't no skank.
Yeah. So Jesse frantically wipes down everything that he touched. And as he's wiping down the ATM machine, of course, it pops open and spits money out. So he grabs a bunch of money, he calls 911, and as he's headed out the front door, he stops and he goes back for the kid, telling him to cover his eyes as he carries him through the house. And then he leaves the kid on the front doorstep and takes off.
All right, so Aaron, you're the guest. We thought we'd let you go first and let us know your overall impressions of this episode.
As part of prepping for this episode, I watched the episode, but I actually went back and listened to the podcast recorded, which was, God, I don't know how long ago it was. To kind of see like if my takes had drifted. But I think I agree with Aaron from about 8 years ago that this is an early kind of standout gut punch episode. You know, Breaking Bad had been a dark comedy and had been badass, but like something that really made you feel like dirty watching it. Something yeah. like, you know, some of the season four episodes of The Wire. This kid, he's actually played by little twin actors. And I, out of a weird twist of fate, I got to meet these, this kid at a Breaking really? Bad Fest. These kids, yeah, and their mom. This kid just like really guts you. And what's really, you know, extra pathetic is knowing that like this is kind of real life. There are, I kept on thinking about 5 years ago, there was this headline in the local Cincinnati newspaper where there was a picture of a couple in a minivan in the front seat passed out because they were on, you know, it was probably oxy.
Probably opiates, yeah.
Yeah, it's yeah, that was the drug kind of sweeping things of the day. And there's this kid, like, in, you know, the seat behind them, just kind of, like, playing quietly by himself, clearly awake and conscious in a car seat. And it's just like, fuck. You really felt yeah. that, meeting Spooge and his old lady and this poor, unfortunate child. It really made you feel. And it's so funny to watch Jesse coming up and he's prepping for all the wrong confrontations. Like, he's like, you know, give me my money, bitch. Give me my money. But what really confronts him and what really... kills him is this little kid. So yeah, and then of course there's a huge moment in Walt development with the fuck you to Gretchen. It's a pretty standout early episode.
Yeah, and I that's what I wrote in my notes too, was it's an icky episode overall. Like, it's very good, but there it's just uncomfortable at times. And it's funny because I didn't get a chance to listen to the Insider podcast this week in preparation, but I did. I was interested in how they find a house like this, or how they stage a house like this, because I was kind of under the impression that they would get like a vacant house and then they would have to do that, you know, sort of mess it all up. But I mean, it looks so messed up when you watch it that it's hard to imagine how they would do that, right? And I found a quote from Aaron Paul saying that actually this house was just a neighborhood house owned by someone who was a hoarder and you know, just had a ton of cats and everything like that, and they actually cleaned the house up somewhat in order to use it to be, you know, make it so that they could actually shoot in there, which blew my mind. And it's just like, what I thought was kind of amazing about this episode was the way that Walt carries himself in that conversation with Gretchen manages to be equally as disgusting as this house, you know, like, it's just I think it's a wonderfully orchestrated back and forth between those two people. And it exposes more about Walt than we've seen. And it, you know, it's weird because it forces her to sort of draw this line and contact Skyler and say she can't help anymore. it kind of works out in Walt's favor at the end, because it you know, gives him a little bit of relief around the house, because now he's not the bad guy. He's more of like, wow, this is a terrible thing that's happening to us together. So it sort of brings them, kind of fixes some things that's going on with them. And the other thing, just to go back really quickly about the house and the situation with the kid, I mean, it's really difficult to see and know that, you know, that this happens to children, you know, like throughout the country, like you brought up, Aaron. And it's funny, because it's not funny, but it's a nice connection there that, you know, this is directly related to what Walt and Jesse are doing. And we see this softer side of him here, but it's also the kind of thing that just sort of makes it like certain that he's going to continue to do this, you know, like he just sort of like, he's like entrenched even more in the whole process, you know, going out and collecting this debt and being the man or whatever else. So what about you, Courtney?
Yeah. So one of the things, Aaron, that we've been thinking a lot about is like the legacy of the show and how it resonates to an audience in 2023. So I actually remember the story you just told about that family in Cincinnati, about how the mother and father were, I think, dead, right? When they found the toddler.
Was it
in the
that?
Car.
I know that they're passed out, but I wasn't sure they were dead. Wow.
Yeah. So, but like in 2009, when this episode was first aired, right, like certainly like there were pockets of the country dealing with epidemics and drug crises and things like that, but not to the extent that we really saw with the opioid crisis that really took a hold of the country in like the last 5-10 years, right? So I think it resonates in a slightly different way today when you rewatch it. It really is like, you know, like, and we mentioned this, I think, maybe not in the last episode, Peepa, and the one before, but we were talking about this character of Spooge. And we do get to see Spooge in Better Call Saul, like before he turns into this Spooge, and mm-hmm. Just like how different he looks and how much cleaner he looks and healthier he looks. I mean, obviously, he still goes to Saul Goodman for legal advice. So he did something. But I wonder if that's something that they were thinking about when they wrote Better Call Saul.
Yeah, I think they were trying to undo that progression, right? I mean, that's like Spooge Prime before it really got a hold of him. And yeah, like here, that I don't think you could better present a couple who it's got a hold of in, you know, in a better way than what they do here. It's horrifying.
It is. It is horrifying, and just given what's happened in the United States in like, you know, the last 10 years or so. Even more so, because I think probably everyone knows of someone who's been affected by addiction and the drug crisis, right? So something you said, Pete, about how this episode really reveals Jesse's softer side, that's, again, something that stood out to me, especially upon rewatch, and like how he won't squash the bug at the beginning. He bends down and, you know, plays with it. And the way that he helps that little kid, I think that's in such stark contrast to the Walt we're presented in this episode. And just how hardened and cynical and nasty he's really become. So you likened him to the squalor of that house. And by the way, Pete, I did listen to the Insider podcast and they did talk about the house on it. Mm. And so it was like this older woman who let them shoot in her house. So it is a real location. And I think they did mention she had something like 14 cats and dogs in the place. So it was a bit of a mess. Anyway, yeah. So for me, rewatching
this, that
was
a really, really pleasant set to shoot on. The smell must have been just perfect.
They did talk about it, yeah.
In my notes, whenever I was watching it, that's what I wrote down, because like the very first thing he does when he goes in is he sits down on the couch, and I swear that just makes my skin crawl thinking about like what that, you know, because there's. Because, like, you know, there's your mess and your smells and the things that you do that you get used to. And then there's, like, some rando who you're right there to collect your money from. And, like, that is, I mean, I guess he was getting all geared up, smoking up in the car before he went in. So he might have been, you know, had other things on his mind or whatever. But I can only imagine what that would be like to sit down there on that couch at that time.
Ugh, it really is, again, one of those really visceral episodes, right, where like you feel like you can smell it as you're watching it. And when he's sitting on the couch with the kid, like the way they stained the couch and, you know, with a little duct tape on the armrest part of it. And oh man, the sound effects in this one. So like when they pull the condoms full of drugs out of their bodies, and then of course the sound of the ATM, it's really disgusting. It's so gross. But just one other thing, rewatching this, something that occurred to me that I don't think I ever thought of when I watched this episode before. Have either of you seen the Funny or Die webisode with Will Ferrell and the little baby who plays his landlord?
I don't think so. Uh-uh.
Oh, okay. I'm going to share the link with you later. It's hilarious. It's a classic. So I had to actually look it up because I was curious. I haven't thought about it in years. It came out in 2007. And so the story is Will Ferrell is in his apartment and, his landlord is coming to collect rent. And so he's inside with a friend and he's nervous. And then he opens the door and it's a toddler. It's like this 2-year-old girl. And she starts cursing at him and screaming, "I want my money, bitch. I want my money, bitch." And it reminded me so much of how Jesse is trying to pump himself up before he goes in the house. "Give me my money, bitch." It's funny.
You mentioned this too, Pete. This is a real transformational episode for Jesse. Like, he grows up a lot in, you know, just in terms of him having to think on his own feet, like that high speed, that frantic, trying to wipe down all of his prints and get out of there clean. You know, the fact that he's trying to do something right by the kid. I feel like Jesse grows up a lot in this season and this episode in particular. And I really enjoyed that aspect that, like, this, he's come a long way since the pilot episode, you know, his Captain Cook days.
Yeah, and it's a nice parallel with what's going on with Walt, because you see that there's some good in Jesse and there's maybe a little bit more bad than Walt than you previously thought. You know, like, there's definitely that they're playing with there.
Yeah, and how they get you pumped up in the beginning of the episode with, like, you know, Skinny Pete and Jesse essentially trying to both get out of making the collect call, right? And then Jesse reluctantly doing it and him gearing up to be like this action man of violence. And, you know, the whole time you're thinking, oh, is he going to be able to do this? He's going to put the gun. And the moral quandary that they get you set up for what actually happens when it's so great how it's anticlimactic. The door opens and there's nobody home. And it's like, you never see that in shows. Like, when Tony's dudes in The Sopranos go to break someone's legs, he's never just, "Oh, I just missed him. He ran out the smoke," and, you know, they got to come back. Or Jesse's like, "Yo, what the hell? Where are all these people?" And then, right as that's kind of settling, like, this is kind of an anticlimax, this kid just bust open the door, pops on, you know, the Home Shopping Network and chills out. And Jesse's
watches
like,
the Knife Channel, which is the only, like, channel they get.
in 60 seconds, you go from, like, is Jesse going to be able to put the gun on these guys to, like, oh my God, Jesse's going to have to figure out what to do with this kid. Like, and also, like, what's he that this kind of limits his options. Is he going to orphan this kid? It's a really interesting and sophisticated bait and switch they play with us. And I thought it was, it really made the add a lot of spice to the beginning of the episode.
Yeah. And this episode really lets Jesse off the hook. So Walt has put him on this business. He wants him to go in and collect the dope that they stole, and he's prepared to do it. But then, you know, as we watch the episode, he's exempt from having to actually do it because they hit him over the head with a bottle. They take the gun and the wife ends up killing Spooge, and Jesse still gets the money. So in a way, he's walking away from it clean. I mean, if you can call that clean. I mean, it's still literally blood money that he picks up off the floor as it's spitting out of the ATM machine. But it's an interesting take on how Jesse's, I guess, his moral compass, right? So we do see that shift, how he's walking and prepared to do what he has to do. And then what is instead revealed is this much softer, compassionate side. And what really begins this trend with Jesse in wanting to protect innocents, especially children. So we see it first here with Spooge's kid. And then we later see it, of course, with Brock, how he feels about Andrea's little brother, Tomas. And the kid on the dirt bike, Drew Sharp, right? So Jesse becomes a defender of innocence, and it starts here.
Yeah, and I don't know if it, was there anything else you wanted from your overall impressions, because I wanted to skip to that part about like the introduction. Like it wasn't really a teaser. That's it was a linear teaser this week, but was there anything else before we go into that?
I mean, I had a couple of other things, but I'm sure there'll be opportunity later.
Take a break. Wander around in a fugue state. We'll be right back.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and ball move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Tight. We're back with more GDT. All right. So yeah, what you know, you were just talking about the way that ends in the house with Mrs. Spooge, I guess. It's funny because the whole gag is that he never calls her a name. That really, that you can only really refer to her as Skank because that's how she's been introduced by her significant other there. But as I think you said it earlier, you know, the other option is Mrs. Spooge.
I think she's credited in the episode as Spooge's woman. I think that's how the actress.
Yeah, that's the way that Skinny Pete says it, right? And that's what I was thinking about. You know, you brought up the idea that Jesse, you know, he's looking at the beetle. He picks it up. He's obviously kind of fascinated with it. And Skinny Pete comes over and he stomps it without thinking, you know what I mean? And that you know, the way that Spooge meets his end is very similar. Mrs. Spooge has something that she wants. He's pushed her buttons to the point that, you know, she's willing to squash him like a bug, and really with the same amount of of concern. You know what I mean? It's just like, this thing is in my way and now I'm going to stomp it.
Yeah, and it does call back to a line that Hank said previously when Walt, Hank, and Junior are standing outside barbecuing. And Walt says to Hank something like, where do these criminals come from? And Hank says, you know, like cockroaches, you know, they just come out and you don't think about it. You just stomp them, right? So this idea of this kind of low life or squalor, right? You don't think about criminals as human. At least that's Hank's point of view. And the callousness of what she does to him, you know, over nothing, right? Calling her a skank. But yeah, I love, I think, of course, that was very intentional how they have that squishing sound right at the outset as of, you know, sort of foreshadowing what's going to happen to Spooge's skull, give him a cranial, right?
Rewatching, I thought it was interesting how I didn't necessarily remember, you know, as a key part of the episode, the way that Skinny Pete kind of puffs himself up and says, you know, because if you don't want to do it, I can do it, which is obviously, right. You know, no, I really want you to take care of this because I don't want to have anything to do with these people that, you know, are obviously unhinged and pulled a knife on me. You know what I mean? But he's got to kind of look tough in front of his boss, I guess. I think that it's hilarious how they sort of go in that little circle and then it's the thing, like, Walt just, if we remember back to the last episode, Walt just showed up at Jesse's house and demanded that he did this, you know, like he goes to fix this. And, you know, just the way that they push each other into it when no one really wants to do it. And then, like you pointed out, Aaron, how he gets there and he's trying to, you know, put so much time into trying to pump himself up, but it's all for nothing. It's basically, these are two incompetent meth heads that are just, you know, basically not the smartest people around, and they're just sort of like not really that big of a problem, but because of the way the situation plays out, it, you know, there's this delay of like when he can actually get this done. I mean, because if you think about it, this is something that should have taken 5 minutes, you know what I mean? Instead, it ends up being the whole day that he's stuck there. And it, instead of it being like they're outsmarting him or anything else, it's just like there's no way for him to move forward in the situation.
You mentioned Courtney, I thought, said something that got in the general thoughts that kind of got my wheels spinning when she says that Jesse's kind of let off the hook morally because he didn't have to kill Spooge. And what, you know, Breaking Bad's loaded with these chiral forms, kind of like these reflections of different character arcs. And I think it's interesting that in season two, Walt, towards the end, will have a kind of similar situation where he gets to choose, you know, he doesn't have to get his hands dirty and kill someone. He just refuses to lend assistance and he kind of is let off the hook morally. That's just something that, you know, the audience judges him for. But and it's also an interesting contrast because Jesse, if I recall correctly, uses this to springboard a little bit of street cred that, hell yeah, I'm the guy that caved in Spooge's head. And, you know, people are kind of afraid and they respect him versus Walt, who kept the secret of his complicity in the death secret. I thought that's interesting contrasts between the protagonists here.
It is. And what you're talking about, Aaron, is and I think in the next episode, the whole blowfish speech that Walt gives him because Jesse is really distraught over what happened and he's not answering his phone calls. And, you know, sleeping on a sleeping bag in his new apartment. And it's Walt's idea, actually, to I guess, borrow that street cred, you know, that everyone thinks that he did this. And it works for a short period of time. But something that I've been thinking about, and this is how Pete, you opened this episode with your question about street names and things like that. And this idea of identity and naming oneself. So we see a lot of that in this series. So Jesse's idea of a tough name being Diesel, right? And then Walt christening himself, of course, as Heisenberg. And then we see that also with Better Call Saul, and Saul Goodman isn't even his real name. He's Jimmy McGill. So I think it's really interesting about how these characters view themselves. And Aaron, to get back to what you were talking about, like with these chiral, you know, opposite, but the chemically similar, of images or beings, in this case, Walt and Jesse. This really is an interesting inversion at this point. So Jesse is supposed to be the street guy, the tough guy, but of course we know that Walt is really the psychopath behind this operation, the one that doesn't have the moral qualms that Jesse has. And this episode really lays that bare. And I think later on in the series we'll see a lot more examples of that.
Well, it comes back to, you know, the other thing about Walt and Jesse is like their sense of personal responsibility. Like that's something that Walt's always paying lip service to. But like when you look at the deaths in the series, Walt's always finding other people to blame or reasons why it's acceptable, or, you know, he's justifying himself, whereas Jesse always takes it personally, you know, and turns that criticism inwards instead of externally. And it's one of the reasons it's like, I don't know if it's fair to say that Walt doesn't feel the impacts of his death. It's just that he's always finds a way to reconcile it, you know, with like, I had to, or, you know, it's a blowfish theory, or, you know, I was given no choice. Whereas Jesse, you know, kind of eats at himself. And it's one of the reasons I think, you know, deep down, it's like Walt is incapable of resisting the spiral into the abyss, where, you know, Jesse, I think they make a compelling case in El Camino that, you know, he's at least trying to, because he still hasn't, you know, given up his humanity.
Yeah. And I think that progression that the way that they laid those decisions out, you touched on it earlier, you know, we were talking about them being let off the hook and those, all those choices, you know, watching this closely and going back and knowing everything that's going to happen and going through these episodes. That's one of the things that we've mentioned a couple of times now, was that, you know, the part of the reason why you're not completely turning on Walt is because in the earlier situations he did sort of not have a choice, you know, like his first big kill, which we were reminded of recently whenever the bike lock came back out. But you know, when he kills Crazy Eight, he's trying to pump himself up, and then it just actually presents itself where he has to do it because, you know, he has that piece of plate, and if he lets him go, he's going to stab him. Each of these things, you know, it just keeps progressing that way until we get to that point with Jane, you know, where we're watching. That's where you really start to say, well, hey, he made that as a decision. Like, he was right there. He could have changed what happened, and he chose not to. And so, yeah, it's interesting to see how these things are going along. And then, as you both mentioned, how they, even though he had nothing to do with Spooge, they're happy to take that on as him being some kind of badass, because, you know, it furthers their interests going forward. And I guess, like, I was going to go in a different direction, but I think with what we're talking about now, it makes sense for us to talk about the sit down between Gretchen and Walt. I guess just, you know, to mention it, I don't know if there's anything we need to say there, but this is another one of those opportunities, right, where Walt is not going, he's controlling the conversation so that Skyler doesn't know what's going on with them. And then this thing presents itself. It's a chance for her to reach out to Gretchen and thank her for this thing that she thinks that she's doing. It's a big deal. And then that leads to Gretchen coming over and Walt being surprised that she didn't, you know, tell the truth. And then they have this meal. There's so much that happens in this back and forth. Like, I think it's really just perfectly set up for us to see another layer of who Walt is. And, you know, I thought, like, the thing that really stood out was when she said, "What happened to you?" You know, and of course, he looks at that and says, well, you know, of course, what happened to me was that I got screwed out of my money, you know, going back to that idea of H. Tracy Hall and the synthetic process for, you know, the process for making synthetic diamonds. He was talking, you know, he thinks that what happened to him was that they screwed him out of his money. But she lays it out pretty clearly that he walked away. You know, that's not exactly what happened at all. Like he just bounced and now he blames them. And that's where you have to come to the question then, is maybe nothing happened to him. Maybe he always was just this way. That's who he is. And so whenever she says, this isn't you, she's just wrong. You know what I mean?
Well, I think a couple things, right? So one thing that I wanted to touch on really quickly, and this was something that occurred to me in my first impressions, but when he's in the classroom a little bit earlier and he's, you know, going on and on about carbon and giving them this little lesson on carbon, he talks about the man who I guess came up with like the way to synthesize diamonds, this guy, what's his name, H. Tracy Hall. And he talks about how he worked for GE at the time, and the way this man was rewarded was with a $10 US savings bond. And that you can sense from the way Walt focuses on that part of the story that he sees this as like a huge oversight and injustice, right? That this man who generated billions of dollars, and he even says that billions of dollars, for GE and the world, right? And that's what he focuses on.
And students don't even get it at all, which is hilarious to me. Like, they're just like, really? Could you please just wrap this up, whatever this is about?
Yeah. Yeah, well, they're completely checked out most of the time whenever he's talking. And so when we get to this scene with Gretchen, I think we already have a sense of how Walt feels about, you know, people, scientists in particular, not being given their credit and not being given their due. So one of the things that she says to him, that this isn't you, and you, this is what you were alluding to, Pete. And then Walt says, well, what would you know about me? And I mean, I think she obviously knew him well enough at some point in his life. They were in a relationship. They worked together professionally. And what he did was he retreated. He ran away, right? So like whatever happened, and the truth is probably somewhere in between. We have his side. We have her side. And it's probably somewhere in the middle, right? But it is interesting to get these two completely different points of view of what actually transpired and happened that caused them to break up and for him to leave the company. But the Walt that was the Walt at the beginning of Breaking Bad, the Walt that we meet in the first half of the pilot, certainly he's already started to change by the end of the pilot, is this very passive, submissive guy. You know, he's non-confrontational. He doesn't stand up for himself. He doesn't argue. And maybe that's always just been his MO, is he just FOs, right? When the stress is too great or whatever. So and we really start to see that shift at the end of the last episode, where he wants Jesse to handle this problem with the Spooges. He gives him the gun. He wants to be Tuco, right? So he took that very literally about like, we have to be Tuco. We have to project this image of toughness. No one fucks with us. Nobody can rip us off, sort of thing. So he is at this point completely changed. And so it is, I think, maybe in a way Gretchen sees him more clearly than anyone else at this point in time can. And he's happy to let her really see him too. That really cold fuck you to her is, you get the sense that that's a real honest moment with him.
Yeah, he's been carrying that one around in his back pocket for a while. He's just been waiting to drop that one out. I mean, yeah, like that. When I was watching this, I was taking notes, and I was like, okay, I can't just write down every single thing that they say back and forth to each other, you know. But it's really like the dialogue is really like that. Like every single thing that they say is important, and as far as like what's going on with him, what will happen with him in the future, how he became this way. Like it's all kind of laid out right there. Hey, Ron, whenever I had you guys on and we talked about that, you know, we sort of talked about this idea, was Walt always this way? And it just sort of came out because of what happened. And you made the point there about, you thought, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what you were saying was that you believe that we could all be that way, you know, like we all have that kind of thing in us, but we don't, you know, most of us never make it to that point. And perhaps Walt's point was sort of on a hair trigger already.
Well, they say that you talk about things being like genetic. That people have a predisposition to susceptible to heart disease, or they have a predisposition to have anxiety disorder, or they might have a predisposition towards alcoholism or violence. But like a geneticist will tell you that like genes need, you know, genes also need an environment in which to express themselves. You know, like there's two things. It's not just the genes. It's also what environment they express themselves into. And I guess that's what I was going for, because when I was re-listening to our old podcast, I was kind of struck by how still, you know, this was 8 years ago. I was surprisingly sympathetic to Walter. And like, I think when I first started when I was watching this season 2 for the first time, I was much more sympathetic to him because we haven't seen the full depths of his the depravity. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, because you can see it's like, you know, would Walt have turned into a psychopath if America had, you know, a socialized medicine system to where he didn't feel like that he had a choice between leaving his family destitute or dying of cancer? You know, like, is this a class issue? Because I look at this conversation, I see Gretchen, who is a wealthy woman, and Elliot, who's a wealth. They both come from wealth, or
yeah,
generational
I mean, he,
wealth,
he,
right?
He throws that in her face in this conversation. He says, little rich girl always gets what she wants, or something. I'm paraphrasing.
Adding to her millions.
And I think there might be a real disconnect between he goes out to this family retreat. And let's say that her dad and her two brothers, or however, took him to the side and be like, look, our sister's soft-hearted and soft-headed, and she's been fucking with you. You're trash class, whatever. Long enough, she's been infatuated, but it's time to end this. And like, I think that's something that you could feel very offended and want to be like, fuck all that. But like, you know, and go off half-cocked and kind of withdraw. And then I can also see a person that's super wealthy, like thinking that it'd be fine to go ahead with the ideas that we had been discussed as a threesome. If this guy doesn't want to be in part of the company anymore, like, what's the big deal? Because they don't understand the importance of like, a discovery like that, a guy like Walt that can change his life, because, you know, their lives are pretty much on a trajectory. And there's, so it's like, I can see in the margins, but like, it's, you know, when you get to late season Breaking Bad and you see what Walt's capable of, like, whatever gene he was capable of is fully expressed, and it's awful.
Yeah.
And but it's just like one of those things where it's like, God, if like, what are all the things that had to go wrong in Walt's life to get him in this spot? It doesn't excuse it, but like, it does feel like Gretchen and Elliot are a little bit out of touch. And it did feel like the Walt felt like there was a big class divide and he didn't belong and he wasn't entitled to. And maybe that he thought deep down that Gretchen felt that way too. This wasn't just her dad, but that's something that she would have seen as an inadequacy in her time. Now again, this all goes back to Walt's own insecurity, mm-hmm. and Walt's failure to engage and stand his ground and fight on something, instead of, you know, going to Gretchen and be like, your dad and your brother said this, is this how you feel, is this how you, you know, he just fucking takes off and ghosts her. But yeah, I think it's there's so many things where you could see it's like, if this little thing was changed, if Walt was just like 10% less prideful, because it felt like at the beginning of the series too, that him and Skylar were disconnected too. If he was a little bit, they were still a little bit more connected, invested in the relationship. You know, if they didn't have a hard road the hoe with Walt Jr., like, could his life been completely different? But yeah, it's mostly just interesting to see how much I was still willing to carry a little bit of Walt's water 8 years ago, to whereas like when I was watching this episode today, it's just like, God damn, look at this guy blowing through flashing red light after flashing red light, and his poor wife just getting,
Well, hindsight is always 20/20, right? So like, of course, knowing what we know, it's, you go back and you're like, you know what? He was an ass from the beginning, but I think probably that is like kind of more or less the universal experience when if you're watching it for the first time, you're completely in Walt's corner still. At least I was. Don't forget your pants. We'll be back after this short break.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Fire up the RV. We're back with more Growth, Decay, Transformation.
I was gonna say, that's what really jumped out at me at this particular episode this time. Like, it's made explicit, you know what I mean? Like, there's really no two ways about it. Like, this conversation with Gretchen is unhinged from, you know, if you look at it objectively. Like, she's saying, how does this not concern me? Like, you're using me in your lie with your family. Like, I'm definitely involved in this situation. And he's just like, nah, it doesn't concern you. That's it. Don't worry about it. You know what I mean? Like, it's really like all right there.
I do think, oh boy, I'm getting dragged into the argument again. I do think there's a little bit of Gretchen, like, okay, your name has been drug into the fact that Walt has told a lie to his wife and child to explain how he's paying for the cancer treatment. And given your guys' personal history and given the, you know, like the somewhat embarrassing nature of being put in a position of asking for money, it's like, I feel like Gretchen, she centered that on herself an awful lot. You know, like, have you ever thought about how this impacts me and my husband? Well, okay, Walt's dying of cancer. So, like, maybe he, I still think that, like, also that and the way they cast this, I forget what this woman's name, but she got cast in the late 90s and early 2000s as just as like a hateable person. Yeah.
She was on Friends, right?
She was Ross's ex-wife that kind of treated, it's like she's also kind of like, I think like, she's supposed to be like guys of that era's nightmare girlfriend slash wife slash just like, oh God, if I was married to that, I would die, because she's just going to henpeck me and she's going to sneer at me. And like, Vince knew all that.
Oh,
and
yeah,
I feel like I feel like sometimes Vince like decries the fact that he did so well in setting up some of these characters to be kind of and Walt to be sympathetic, that it was like a Frankenstein's monster that he lost control of. And it was like, oh Jesus, I can't believe the people got the pitchforks and the fire. But like, some of this stuff is, he designed, I think, season one Skyler to be a good antagonist and a good thwarting, a good foil to Walt. I think he designed Gretchen and Elliot to be the exact same thing. And, you know,
we got into this last episode because we were talking about the decision to have her smoke while she was pregnant, you know, like, There was a lot of other things that they could have chose there, but that's something that people just universally are looked down upon. You know what I mean? Like people can't really forgive that because of the victim there has no choice. You know, like they're just completely victimized. You know what I mean? The unborn
baby.
There
are a lot of confounding factors, but it would have been a crappy show if it had just been all one side of Walt's clearly evil from the beginning.
Oh yeah.
And, it is like you said, the hindsight being 2020, it's like I try to balance, you know, like, oh, this was obvious that Walt was this diabolical, despicable character from the beginning from like, well, I don't know. I think there was like some genuine murky areas. And there's also Walt, even though he's a despicable person, he has complicated feelings about his family and about Jesse in particular.
Yeah.
Where Jesse is like a threat and Jesse is more of a son than Walt Jr.
Yes,
in some ways,
yes,
and he cares for him that way, but he's also competing with him, and Walter is not just he's a sympathetic villain, and I think he remains that throughout the series. Mm-hmm. Even if you're rooting for him to either escape or get his at the end, he still maintains some because who can't identify with a person being with your back against the wall.
Yep. So, Aaron, you said a whole bunch of things. There are a couple of things I wanted to respond to. So, the actress that plays Gretchen is Jessica Hetch, and she's actually married to Adam Bernstein, who works on Breaking Bad. But there was something about this scene or this episode that I thought was really interesting. So, the decision that Gretchen didn't automatically come out and tell Skylar, like, what are you talking about? When they first have that phone call and Skylar starts thanking her, instead she's like, I'm coming over. So she's withholding information to gain information. And we see Walt do the same thing later with Skylar when he's trying to figure out what Gretchen said when she called, right? So he's withholding information when they're sitting on the couch, trying to figure out how much Skylar already knows. Because you can see it on his face. Like, he thinks he's been outed already. And he thinks that it's going to be this conversation where he has to tell her about how and why he lied. But again, gets off the hook, right? So Jesse gets off the hook. Walt gets off the hook here. But I thought that was really interesting. And something that you said, Aram, was like, is Gretchen really all that innocent, right? Like, so why doesn't she tell Skylar? And why does she go along with Walt's lie? She makes herself complicit with the lie, right? So that's a choice that she makes. And then she uses that as leverage over Walt. So there is this really strange power dynamic that happens between the two of them. And the other thing I wanted to mention
was... I think the implication is, real quick, I think the implication is that she wants answers about why Walt did what he did back then too, right?
Yes. I think that is definitely the subtext there, right? So like, there's a lot that's been unsaid and there's...
Which makes it very complicated, yeah.
Yes, it does. It does. But going back to another point that you made, Aaron, this idea of class differences, this is something that we've talked quite a bit about on this podcast. And it's something that we talked a lot about when Jim was on when we did Gray Matter. So a couple of things like with just how uncomfortable Walt and Skylar are moving in that space when they go to the Schwartz's house. You can see the physical discomfort. They're embarrassed by their clothing. And I think that's, again, a sort of common experience. I think some people feel
super relatable. Sometimes.
Yeah. Like if you don't come from exorbitant wealth, right, it can be uncomfortable to be around that kind of wealth for some people. Right. Because of like, and that's like a whole other discussion, like the whole idea of class and the structures that are like inherent in the United States of America in particular. But I think that's really an interesting thing. And just one thing I wanted to...
America is a classless society. We left all that behind in Britain.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, no castes here, right? But just
no lords and ladies allowed in this country. We're all equal. All equal.
Yeah, but just one other thing. I got the impression that Elliot does not come from money. So he married into Gretchen's wealth because if you'll remember in Grey Matter, when they're talking, Walt and Elliot were roommates and they survived on ramen noodles. So you got this idea that they were both really, really poor. So I think that adds something.
Oh, they were both Billy Joel's to her Christie Brinkley.
Exactly.
Okay.
So I think that adds to like Walt's wounded ego, right? Is because he did have the girl. He had the brains, he had the girl, he had the company, and he walked away. Now this nebbish Elliot, you know, gets it all, right? So I think that's like somewhat salt in the wound. So when Elliot, you know, tries to offer him the job, it just like, that's like the biggest insult to him. This idea of like their charity and their pity is just so abhorrent and repulsive to him. And we really see that play out with Gretchen in this episode, where the real emotion comes from. So we got a sense of it, but he doesn't really seem to harbor any bad feelings towards Elliot. It seems to really be centered on whatever happened with him and Gretchen. At least that's my impression.
It is interesting that Vince never gave us a good glimpse of what the truth was. You know, was there any, you know, but I don't think there's any truth that would justify the many, many murders and other things that Walt did over his criminal career. But it's just like one of the things I've always wondered is like, you know, what happened in that July 4th thing?
Right.
Like how was it? Because, you know, what did her brothers and dad say? It seems unlikely to me that Walt would just fly off the handle because he got out there and, you know, there was a money flying around. I bet they did, you know, whether intentionally or no, I bet they did say something that made him feel, you know, less than or inadequate or, you know, unable to provide her the lifestyle in which that he was, you know, she's accustomed to, whatever.
You were talking about this a little bit, Courtney, but we did sort of get into that in the last. Then whenever Jim was here, when we did Gray Matter, the idea that, you know, at that point, you really see, you're really going through Walt's point of view and you really see Gretchen and Elliot as bad guys, where they're not perfect, obviously. And, you know, this goes back to what you're saying before, like you can kind of see where Walt's coming from, you know what I mean? It's not like he doesn't know them. It's not just blind resentment. There are things, you know, at play here that make it complicated. And with, you know, the idea is that they're not quite as bad as he sees them. And, you know, so when I say that, like, it's right there in front of you, you should see it. It's a lot better than that because hopefully, you know, whenever they're putting it together, they're thinking about how we're going to filter that information, like what they're presenting to us. And, and we say, you know what, if I don't like either one of these people, maybe, but I kind of like Walt better because, you know, because he's, you know, he's in this situation and at least he's doing something. But I was just saying, like, you know, when you watch it now with full information about where this is going, It's pretty in your face in a way in this scene that I hadn't realized before.
Well, just one other thing I was going to say about this whole thing about how Walt feels about other people. And I think like they kind of tell us everything we really need to know about Walt and how the world has treated him and how he sees himself from the pilot. So this idea of like what may have happened at the 4th of July weekend at Gretchen's family's house, maybe they you know, made some sort of snide comments that made him self-conscious. Maybe it was nothing. Maybe he interpreted it to mean something, right? Like about his lack of status or something like that. And but when we see like how his own brother-in-law treats him in the pilot, how Hank talks to him and talks about him in front of like groups of people, you know, he's constantly emasculating him, telling him he looks like Keith Richards with a glass of warm milk. You know, when he's holding the gun, he makes fun of the way he's holding the gun and says something like, that's why they let men do it. So you get the sense that Walt has not ever stood up for himself, right? Like he just turns inward. And I think that's a great point that you made, Aaron, talking about Jesse, how he starts to turn more inward and then Walt starts becoming more reactive with time. So again, like we see this sort of a reversal of roles for those two characters, but Walt really just explodes, right? Like, and we see it come out in a couple different ways before it gets really, really bad as the series goes on. But like, I guess I'm thinking of like Ken Wins and how he, you know, puts the window squeegee on his battery and blows his car up and stuff like that. So Walt isn't going to take shit from anyone anymore. And I think, you know, whatever resentments or grievances he has, it's more than just whatever happened with Gretchen. It's like his whole life, he sees himself as this victim that everyone has just dumped on and taken advantage of. At least that's the impression I get from him. Certainly rewatching it, like this is just someone that has a huge chip on his shoulder and wants everyone else to suffer because of it.
Well, there's a common phrase in therapy here that is the opposite of crazy is still crazy. And Walt was acting in the pilot episode. He's his crazy life. Like his life is not even his own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's doing everything he doesn't. He's just so passive. Excuse me. I just inhaled a bug or something. he's so passive. He's so, you know, barely has a pulse, that, you know, like the center that you're looking for between this passivity and this naked aggression is assertiveness. But Walt just can't find that balance. He careens from being mm-hmm. this passive, submissive person to this very reactive, very active, very aggressive, very dominant person. And he can't ever find that center. And, you know, dying of cancer probably doesn't is not effective therapy. And it's probably not a great way to get into a centered, fully integrated space as a man. But yeah, it's you can see that he, you know, he wants to be the opposite of where he was. But that is just as unhealthy as where he's coming from.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's the two extremes. It's those chirals again. So you have the active, inactive, yep. and the explosive on the other side.
Yeah, I got pretty excited when I was watching this to see them back in the classroom. You know, I'm like, oh, there's going to be some big lesson about what they had in mind for Walt's character or whatever. So we got that the H. Tracy Hall, the inventor of the synthetic diamond. I did look into that a little bit. I was surprised to hear that they had this process in the 1960s. I think he said, I didn't make a note of it, but that synthetic diamonds have existed for all that time. And they never, knowing what you know about how crazy like mining diamonds is and how much crazy stuff happens with that, like that they never replaced them. And, you know, I was looking about it. There's pretty much a big campaign by those companies that or have the, you know, the majority of the share in producing the mined diamonds won't let that happen, basically.
De Beers marketing team cannot be defeated.
Yeah, because when you Google it, all you like the first 10 results are all like why you should avoid man-made diamonds at all costs and things like that. Like the totally right. astroturfed information that's all there. But it kind of, you know, like every time we go in that classroom, you see something about this character, and this is sort of where we're at with him right now, which is why it's a really interesting choice for him to kind of get out of jail with Skylar, because one of the things that really jumped out at me here was that whenever she comes in, and you don't, like, we don't know what Gretchen has revealed yet, right? Like, we're in the same spot as Walt is. Skylar's holding all the cards, and we're kind of expecting, based on what's happened in the last few episodes, for the bomb to drop, you know, for her to be like, this is the last straw. But she ends up being sympathetic because of the fact that they aren't paying anymore. And you know, what jumped out to me about that situation was like her not knowing, you know what I mean? Like how much of a betrayal is all of that? Like if you could put yourself in her shoes and find out like what's really been going on in to keep up this whole thing, you know what I mean?
Well, and you add up the amount of danger that he's putting her and Walt Jr. in without her knowledge and, you know, it's like, it's not just the lies and the fact that he's got this internal life that he's keeping from her, but it's also just like how much danger he's putting the family in without them even being aware of it.
Exactly.
That's the really crazy thing.
Yeah, that's where that not knowing part is. It's like, it's awful, you know, like that's the kind of stuff that you find out and you're just like, it makes you question your reality, you know, the whole existence of everything. Like, what is the point if the person that's closest to me would mislead me in this way, you know?
Yeah, I mean, usually we think of worst case scenarios in terms of personal relationships. You think of like, oh, they might cheat on me, or they might, I don't know, take out another mortgage on the house and lose it all in Vegas. You don't usually think of like, oh, my family might, my husband or wife might get me on the wrong side of psychotic suit wearing axe murderers. You know, that's usually not in everyone's worst case scenario when you're getting you're exchanging vows at the altar. And you know, the fact that these, in large part, I mean, that's the thing. It's like there's a little bit of a fig leaf covering Walt's morality in early seasons where it's like, well, he, you know, what else is he supposed to do? He didn't, his insurance sucks. And, you know, he got screwed by his partners and he's living hand to mouth and he's got cancer. What's he to do? He's like, eyebrow man at the car wash. What am I to do, Walter? I got to cook meth. But like, you know, by the time you get to the end of the series and he reveals that, like, you know, he had an out. Like, most people don't have wealthy benefactors, that maybe you have to humble yourself a little bit. Maybe you have to eat some unsalted crow. But you've got a way that doesn't involve kicking, you know, cooking meth and killing children, providing for your family. And you find out that, like, deep down, what he really did is that he did this for his ego. He did this because he didn't know how to stop being that passive, aggressive, submissive, weak person without overcompensating 100% in the other way. That's where the, you know, that fig leaf gets removed, and you got to come back to, like, you know, you can't make drugs and kill people.
Yeah. And speaking of psychology, like, classic projection in that scene that you're talking about, Pete, when they're sitting on the couch, Walt turns to her, and after, you know, she says that, he comes up with the story that they're going belly up, right? Gray Matter is bankrupt or whatever, and that's why they can't continue paying for his treatment. She's like, why couldn't she just tell me that herself? And he says, they're prideful people, right? And he says, not to sound selfish, but as far as we go, we're going to be okay, right? So, of course, we know that Walt is really the prideful person. And one other thing that stood out to me in this scene that, in rewatching it, that I don't think I made the connection before was Skylar remarks, and yet she still drives a Bentley, right? Like, this idea that they're broke. And then, of course, that's something that comes back later in the series with Ted, remember? After, you know, like, she tries to give Ted the $600,000 that he needs to get out of his trouble with the IRS. And then what does he do? He goes and immediately gets, was it a BMW or whatever it is he drives, you know, and this whole idea of keeping up appearances. So I thought that was a interesting callback that they do to this moment. And feeds into that lie, doesn't it?
I got the impression that at least you, Pete, think that Skylar is still fooled at the end of this episode, whereas, like, I have a clear memory of thinking that this is one of the episodes where the scales are starting to fall. She's starting to put two and two together, like her saying, and yet she drives a Bentley, and the expression, or the way that Walt just, like, 'cause he plays this scene so smoothly otherwise, and he kind of stumbles at this moment. I feel like this is where the things are starting to come to a head for Skylar, and she's starting to figure things out.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, obviously, I've seen the episodes that come after, but, like, I was thinking about that a lot whenever I was watching this scene. And my takeaway is that, one, Anna Gunn is really good. She's a really good actor and the way that she plays it here. And I think that, yes, she still has it, this hasn't, like, wiped the slate clean or anything, and that's what we see, is that she still has a lot on her mind, but that I do think that Gretchen taking away the money does bring them together, because this is it just changes the dynamic of what's happening inside the household. Like, they have paid for the treatment that's already done, but they don't know what's going to come next, and that does bring them at least temporarily closer together. I think it, you're onto something there, that there's a lot more going on in that scene in both of their heads. I don't know, what did you think, Courtney?
Oh, I think she knows it's completely bullshit, and especially in the two episodes leading up to this one where she gives him the whole silent treatment, and the last episode, Pete, we talked about this idea of the cold shoulder and everything, and there was a line that she says to Walt when he accuses her of smoking, right, and he produces this pack of cigarettes she tried to flush down the toilet, and she says, maybe I smoked it in a fugue state. So I don't think she would have said something quite that callous if she wasn't already pretty sure that the whole thing was bullshit. Like, she doesn't believe the fugue state was a real thing. So I think she definitely knows that something's up. He's lying. But her tone is much softer in this episode. Like, when after, you know, he, I guess, disappears after Gretchen leaves, and she's like, should I even ask where you were this time? And she says it in a much softer way than she has in the last couple episodes.
Yeah.
So,
and one other thing I'll just throw in there to, if you guys can expand upon from that place, like, what do we think it is from Walt's point of view? You know, where does Walt, how does this, you know, as far as Walt, like, looking at all the problems he has and things that he had to solve, I think from his point of view, he thinks it solves his problems with Skylar, or for the time being.
Yeah, Walt does, I feel like, think that he has got her pretty well judoed. That, like, oh, I can use this Gretchen pullout as a way to, you know, save some face and make it seem like, you know, that they were broke, and that kind of flatters his ego. There's a little wish fulfillment there. But I think the reason that Skylar's softer is that this Gretchen and Elliot paying for Walt's cancer is something that makes sense to Skylar, mm-hmm. and she can process it. And it's like, oh, and like suddenly, you know, that this is a piece of the puzzle that's like falling in as expected. Like, oh, this is what's going on. And maybe some of the other crazy things that she's been spiraling about. And like, why is my husband acting so? Why is he being so secretive? You know, like, this makes sense. Like, that Walt would be secretive and squirrely about this because he'd be embarrassed. And I feel like that there's a little bit of renaissance, but it's more from like Skylar thinking like, oh, this I've added 2 and 2 in my internal spreadsheet, and this comes out to be 4. And it lasts for barely an episode. It's already crumbling at the end because she's already seeing that, oh, shit, this is adding up to 5 again. That's my take on it anyway.
Yeah, well, I think obviously she knows he's lying about other things. So, but in terms of like where the money is coming from, yes, I think this makes sense to her, because where else would he be getting that amount of money? It hasn't occurred to her that he might be doing like illegal things, I guess, at this point. But this whole exchange with Gretchen obviously stays with her, and she finds it weird. And she, I mean, Walt gets off the hook in a way when they're having this conversation, but it's not something that Skylar ever really puts to rest, because it does come back up later, right? So while he's still disappearing and going off and doing, you know, cooking with Jesse again, she thinks he's having an affair with Gretchen. And if you'll remember, this doesn't happen for some time, but she actually calls Gretchen and asks if they're having an affair. And because she's trying to figure out where the money came from. And then that's when she calls his mother, and she finds out the mother never gave him money. And that's where things really come to a head. And she tells him to get the fuck out, right? She knows something is really wrong. He's doing something illegal to get this money. But Skylar's not stupid. And I love Anna Gunn's acting in the both exchanges, like where she's with Gretchen, and then later with Walt. If you watch her face, you can kind of see like she's not buying it. Like, she thinks something's off, and she's suspicious. And certainly, like, the whole exchange with Walt and Gretchen when he first comes in, when he gets home from work, it's weird, right? And, of course, like, the way it's explained to her, they're bankrupt, they can't afford to give us the money anymore, that's maybe satisfies her temporarily, I guess. But, Pete, if I understand the question you're asking, like, what is Walt's point of view? Does this smooth things over with Skylar? I don't know if he's thinking of that in those terms. I think he just feels like he dodged a bullet, right? Because like, he really thought like he was going to be called out, and for once he's quiet. So in the last couple of episodes, his mistake has been talking too much, right? He's offering too much explanation, and that's how she's able to smell his bullshit. She knows he's lying, like when he tries to explain how his cell phone rang because that was a reminder for his medication, and that's when she's like, uh-uh, you're lying. So instead, he does the opposite. He, as I noted earlier,
he does actually make a shift here.
Yeah, he's definitely holding back. He's like, well, what did she say? You know, so he's trying to get a sense of how much she knows without, you know, revealing what he knows. So he gets her to tell the whole story. So he's learned from his mistakes. He's learned maybe to be a better liar at this point.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate fact of liars, is if you keep giving them chances and chances, they'll eventually get good enough at fooling you that they pretty much will do it all the time.
What do you think Jesse learned from his trip over to Spooge's?
Gosh, it's interesting because like, they really contrast like his home life, which, you know, we've seen is like, you know, his parents were demanding, and there was you know, some problems there. Maybe he had some middle class parent problems, but clearly he can see like, this is like him getting a new appreciation for what rock bottom looks like. You know, like him scolding this mother about like what a terrible mother she is. And it doesn't even affect. I think that there's some part that he is aware of, you know, the fact that he said some things like this to his mom.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Like, that's the thing. It's like, I don't know. I'm not real super impressed with Jesse's parents either. It's like, they're in a bad situation, but, you know, Yeah. How did they turn it? How did a kid like Jesse turn out this way? You know, there was probably a couple. There's probably some issues at home there too, right? But not this severe. I don't know.
Yeah, I doubt if they were that. If it was anywhere close to what we see here, they really made a turnaround since he moved out.
Yeah, but I mean, that's like, you know, like saying that, because I feel like a lot of terrible parents like to point to even worse parents as a way to be like, well, I went ever and beat you or never locked you in a closet for all weekend and you had three square meals a day. It's like, thank you. Thank you for keeping me. Thank you for doing the bare minimum not to get thrown in jail. Appreciate that.
Yeah,
appreciate the bare. Yeah, and I feel like that maybe that's Jesse's parents. Is like they either did the bare minimum or they did way too much of different things that just made him feel like, he wasn't good enough.
And that's
I don't know, maybe he's just a bad seed.
I was just going to say that's such an awful detail in this house, too, is the padlock on the outside of the kid's door.
Yeah, that's gut-wrenching.
Just really makes you feel creepy when you see that.
Yeah.
I think it is. Yeah. It is an interesting contrast, though, between like families, right? So in 204 is when Jesse gets evicted, right? That's the episode where his mom kicks him out of his aunt's house, and they have this argument where he's like, you know, great family mom, you know, evicting your oldest son. And so this idea that Jesse has been wronged or, you know, deprived of something. But then, like, when you see his house and you see, like, his childhood house and you see the way, like, they interact with his little brother, you get a sense that these are, this is a very typical middle class family that are doing what they think they're supposed to be doing. You get a sense that they care about Jesse and they've tried to help Jesse. And this is something that Pete and I have already talked a little bit about in Jesse's family dynamic and, you know, the idea that they're maybe trying to show him some tough love or something like that. But then to see like what a really neglectful or abusive or negligent family looks like. But Jesse, I think, might be carrying around some of his own, as you say, Aaron, some of his own trauma with his mother. And when she says, I'll be any kind of mother you want me to be, when Mrs. Booch says that to Jesse, if he'll just give her a hit, is so gut-wrenching. And also really, you know, to sort of telegraph ahead to when he's with Andrea and he doesn't know that she has a son and they're about to get high because remember he's trying to sell her dope. And then the grandmother comes in with Brock and he goes off on her. He's like, what the hell kind of mother are you? You know, so this idea of neglectful mothers is something that is deeply personal for Jesse. I think that's a wound he carries with him.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Growth, Decay, Transformation. We'll be right back.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what 2-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Well, Let's get cooking. We're back with more Growth Decay Transformation.
Courtney, have you ever had a fluff sandwich?
I can't say that I have. I mean, I've had like s'mores, but I've never actually had a fluff, like the marshmallow spread. No, I've never had one of those.
What about you, Aaron?
I can honestly say I've never had the fluff sandwich or the closely related fluffer nutter, which is peanut butter and marshmallow. I've seen them, but that always seemed like a little too sweet and my savory for me.
I feel for Jesse trying to put something together for this kid, and not probably having very many options, but the fluff sandwich was an interesting detail to have here. I too have never, I don't think I've ever had that in any house that I've ever lived in. I've heard it seemed to come into popularity at some point, like you said, with peanut butter. That was a thing that I know people ate, but I don't think I ever had just pure fluff.
What do you make with marshmallow in a jar? Is that an ingredient? Because I'm trying to think if I've ever seen that in a house that I'm in, and like that and Cheese Whiz, I don't think that's something I ever grew up with.
Oh, we definitely messed with Cheese Whiz.
And like I've seen Cheese Whiz, but I don't think I've ever seen a jar of liquid marshmallow in a person's house.
I imagine it's something you can maybe use for baking. Like, I don't know. Like, I've like made something like Rice Krispie treats, I just melt marshmallow. Like, I make it myself.
Exactly.
I don't know if that's something you could even use, but
I don't. How many jars of marshmallow fluff would you need to make a decent thing of Rice Krispies? Like, so many.
And even more specific for this episode, like, what does Mr. and Mrs. Spooge need fluff for?
And maybe meth causes a sweet tooth or something. I don't know. Maybe, you know, less expensive food, junk food, right?
Yeah. I mean, they're covering all their bases because they seem to do heroin and meth.
It's important to even yourself out, you know. Yeah.
I think the opioids are supposed to be that's supposed to make you have a sweet tooth or enjoy sweet foods or something like that. I guess, you know, there's a little bit more we could probably talk about here. I think we kind of already brought up the idea that that Jesse figures out that they're carrying around their drugs in their butts, basically. And that it was a very, very uncomfortable sound whenever they present those for him. And then
speaking of smells, that's another one where it's like, I'm glad.
Yeah,
I'm glad. God, we don't have smell-o-vision. Mm-hmm. when we're unpacking things.
Yeah, he's carrying. He's holding that later, and it's just like, God, I know where that was.
Wash your hands, dude.
Yeah. Then the captor becomes the captive. You know, they do eventually turn the tables on him, and it's kind of fun to watch how they react to that situation. But really, like, it only comes down to the fact that they're not really concerned with that much more other than getting high. Like, the main thing that's bothering them about the situation is that he's preventing them from getting high in the process of trying to get his money back.
Yep.
Yeah. You can definitely see this like almost train spotting type deal where it's like they're in this bad situation. The first thing they always think about is like, oh man, could really use with the score. Oh yeah, that's the really set us up for the next. Yeah, it's like there's constantly
every chance they get, they bring it up. Like, yeah, you know what would make this better is a little hit. You know,
yeah, it's hard thinking with between you smacking me around with the pistol and not having meth. It's like drug seeking.
And they do. I mean, there are some really funny lines here. I mean, I kind of it's kind of rough, like. Because it's their situation is hard to watch, you know, like especially when it comes to the kid. But then, you know, he says, maybe I need to go see a hospital or something. And then you wonder maybe he did hit him on the head so hard that he might need to go. And in relation to that scene, he says, pull it out of your butts right now, or I'll go grab a flashlight and some pliers and go exploring, which brings some things to mind, or, you know, makes you think of some things there, which are not pleasant at all. We kind of talked about the way that the, you know, the squishing of his head is very similar to the squishing of the beetle. I don't know, Courtney, is there more here that you want to get into when it is related to the Spooges and their end, I guess, their introduction and their send off?
Yeah, so you kind of just mentioned it, Pete, but when Jesse is first talking to them and he hits Mr. Spooge in the back of the head with the, I guess, his gun when they first walk in, and Spooge is on the ground, you know, complaining like, oh, I have a, you know, cranial hematoma. And Jesse's like, I'll give you a cranial, as he's holding the gun on him. And then, of course, you know, that's something that they come back to where he gets the real cranial treatment later. So, so gross. But also, just did you read what Mr. Spooge's shirt says? Did either of you notice? I never read it before, but I actually got up close to the TV so I could read what his shirt says. It said "Wine her, dine her, 69 her." So
yeah,
so gross.
Yeah, it's funny because I had whenever Better Call Saul was on, I had wanted to figure that out, and I couldn't remember what it was, but that is absolutely what it was. That's why I was just silent there when you asked the question, because I was like, oh, I do know what this is, but I didn't look at it the last time I watched it.
So gross. And then,
yeah, he's a certified skankologist, you know, obviously.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess just one other thing that I didn't know, but in doing some research for this episode, the clerk that we briefly see, so like when Spooge is talking about how like stealing the ATM was a victimless crime, and then we get the little flashback to the convenience store, where clearly he murdered the clerk when he stole the ATM. That's the same actor that played the gentleman who hauled the RV out of the ditch that Walt and Jesse drove into in the pilot, right? So that was in Cats in the Bag when the guy pulls it out for them. And remember, Jesse hands him like the meth-covered money. But that poor guy. So we talked a little bit about how everyone that comes into Walt's orbit is doomed, right? And even someone as innocent as a tow truck driver.
Yeah, he's like the gang from Always Sunny. It's just bad news. You don't want to be around him.
Yeah, sure. I did really like that idea of the victimless crime, and the way he keeps saying that. And then, you know, you're kind of like working it out in your head. You're thinking, yeah, I guess so. I guess I'll ask you first, Aaron, have you ever heard of the Raminator?
The Raminator. I might have heard it because, like, I used to work for a C store chain, a large C store chain in the Midwest, and I think I've heard, you know, from circa 2000 to 2009, I heard about every way you could steal an ATM. Getting a big ass truck with a chain and just pulling the whole thing off of that was a very popular way to do it.
Yeah, have you ever heard of this device called the Raminator, Courtney?
It sounds familiar, but I don't know. Tell us, what is the Raminator?
Yeah, well, that's the thing that they came up with for what Aaron's talking about there. It's like a shock absorber they put underneath it. It kind of works like a rubber band, but it's made of steel. As far as what I watched a couple of YouTube videos where the sales reps were talking about these things, and kind of I don't know, they were probably embellishing a little bit about it, but I think they were actually. That came out around the same time this episode came out, because this was a thing that was popular, stealing whole ATMs and taking them somewhere and breaking into them. Like, I was reading, like, they could have had, some of them would have like up to $200,000 in cash inside them, I guess.
Yeah, depending on where they're at and their daily limits and the velocity on them, sure.
Yeah, so, you know, this is a, it's kind of funny because, you know, this isn't like a, it's not exactly something you would call a crime of convenience, or, you know, something like crime of passion or something like that. It's I don't know what you guys think, but it's in that category of crimes that people commit because they like to commit crimes. You know what I mean? Sort of like you sort of, you know, you sit there and you think it up. You're like, well, obviously this is, I mean, you have to bust into the thing and hit it with your car first, or wrap a chain around it and yank it out. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do necessarily, but it can be, you know, you can get a decent payout from it. And yeah, I think you sort of have to just really enjoy like planning a caper and trying to see it through to get into the ATM stealing business.
I enjoy planning capers. I've thought of many ways I could rob from the people who have employed me. It's kind of fun, but like I think there's a certain desperation that's implied with the going through with your caper.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, I looked into it, like, you know, a lot of there was like a huge outbreak of it in Texas, and I think it was maybe 2010 or so. And it turned out to be a coordinated group that was going around and they were doing that. And when they infiltrated that, you know, they got one of the guys on something and then he turned on the rest of them. It actually wiped out a lot of the ones that they were seeing because they were all pretty much connected. You know, it feels pretty random, but at the same time, you know, like you have to have like a, you know, a truck or a stolen truck and a backhoe or something else, you know, like to where you can pull it off. You can't, I don't really know what the implication of how.
Probably a lot of technique too.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what the implication of how Spooge was supposedly pulled this off, but you know, it ended in murder, so I guess that kind of does it. You know, kind of smooths over any details that might be going on there. All right, so let's go in and since you're our guest again, Aaron, we'll let you go first. What was your favorite line? What's the thing that jumped out for you in this episode?
I gotta go with the big gun. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Leveled. That's a Ticonderoga class. Fuck you. That Walt threw onto the table there. It's big and heavy, weighty.
Yeah, like we said, he's been carrying that one around with him for a while. And they, I mean, there's sort of that idea in TV that they could say fuck you as much as they want, but they have an agreement with the advertisers, I suppose. That's how that works, right?
Yeah, and it's also a basic cable thing where it's like, we're going to regulate we're not regulated, we don't want to be, so we'll kind of regulate ourselves.
Yeah.
I noticed that AMC has started to allow their prestige dramas like one fuck per season.
Yeah, I think that you that know, was sort right, of
later seasons of Walking Dead started not having some unbleeped f's. Yeah,
that's the idea I got. This one was definitely bleeped in
the original,
yeah, when it aired on TV from what I read. And it's one of those ones where there's no question of what he's saying. So you might as well you might as well do it, because the way that Bryan Cranston delivers this here, you know exactly what it is. I don't know that anything else works quite as good in that situation. You know,
it keeps the kids that happen to be in the room safe in the episode. You know, they won't be scarred at all seeing their peer. Because that's the really sad thing about that kid's performance, is like, it's so natural and realistic. Like, yeah, what really got me this is like when they're doing the peekaboo at the last and his mom comes and like that genuinely shocks the kid. Like, he's like, oh my god, like this is my friend and my mom just like brained this dude.
Yeah.
He's still like, this kid is still capable of falling for somebody and also to have a new level of like, oh fuck, I didn't know this was part. But yeah, it's so stupid because like, yeah, and that we don't care that someone crushes some another human's head and blood's going to pour all over the place and soak the money. But if someone had to hear the word fuck,
yeah, an expletive,
the very fabric of society would crumble to the ground.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, my thing, my favorite line also has an expletive, one that's a little more palatable, I guess. But yeah, I went with Skinny Pete saying, I can't be all about spelling and shit. You know, he was talking about he's out there slinging and making stacks of Benjamins or whatever, so he can't he can't be bothered with the spelling. What about you?
Of the word street.
Yeah. What about you, Courtney? What was your favorite line?
You know, I almost went with the fuck you. I'm glad I didn't, because that was Aaron's choice. But I had to go with you have a good rest of your life, kid, which is the last line spoken in the episode as Jesse leaves the kid on the doorstep. And I mean, he didn't have to say that. He did what he had to do. He got the kid out of the house, and that was already like, you know, like a, again, the moral right good thing to do, but that he took that moment to spend with that child and to I guess breathe that wish into the world. So we've been talking a little bit about like American culture and stuff like that. So you think, okay, so this kid is going to now become a ward of the state, right? So at least he's out of that household. But if you know anything about you know, the foster care system in this country, it's not always the easiest life. But you know, it's just a really tender moment with Jesse, and I think this episode really is Jesse's episode, and we really get to see his humanity shine through in all of this like grotesqueness. So like you have this again, this really interesting dichotomy of the profound and the grotesque, right? So we have this kid expressing, and I mean Jesse, like this compassion for this child and wanting to protect this innocence in face of this utter depravity and violence and grotesqueness, you know? It really stood out.
Yeah, and what I liked about that one is the awkwardness of it. You know, like it's kind of a weird line, right? It's like, have a good rest of your life. You know, he's not even really that sure when he says it. You know, he's just trying to say something because he just doesn't even know what to do with the situation. Thought Aaron Paul really delivered that one well. And this is an episode that I don't think he doesn't win until later, but this is one of the ones where he was. One of his episodes that was he was nominated for supporting actor in a drama series when the Emmys came around after the season.
Yeah. So, Aaron, what was your favorite shot or your favorite scene in the episode? What stood out to you?
You know, Breaking Bad has a reputation for like kinetic gonzo camera work, and I think an early example is the Beetle Cam. Where you got a camera perspective from Jesse's shoe as he's messing with the beetle, and it's you know, he makes this larger giant like figure. You got the crisp blue Albuquerque sky, New Mexico sky behind him. I like that. It's a good early example of the Tarantino-esque camera work on Breaking Bad.
Yeah, I think. They shot that through a plexiglass, right? So it does cause that distortion. So it's the beetle eye view, right? So I also love how they do object perspective and object point of view in this series. Sorry, Pete, you were going to say something?
Well, I was just going to say that this episode was a little bit weird for picking shots because so many of them happen inside that interior where everything is kind of just gross, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Inside their house. And I did those little flourishes did really stand out in this episode. Like there's one where Walt's coming out of the house chasing after Gretchen, where the clouds, like they look so incredibly, I guess, New Mexican-y or whatever, you know what I mean? just really, really.
They got big skies out there.
Yeah. You know, and so it was those really the contrast of those. But yeah, it was a little bit hard because a lot of the shots in this one, like where there's usually like it's usually hard for me because I have a few that I can't really pin down. And in this episode, it was a little more difficult because there were just less that stood out. Like it's very functional. A lot of the stuff that you see is just really effective and really works well, but it doesn't really stand out in the way that some of the previous episodes we've been talking about have. But I went with the shot of Skank going through Spooge's pockets when he's laying on the floor, and she's, you know, there's the intensity of her like really wanting that bag, you know what I mean? Like she just crushed her partner's head and you see the blood that's there and everything else. And there was this one detail in that shot that really jumped out at me and what put it over the line. It was like, he's got these briefs on and you kind of see his underwear, you know, above his waistband or whatever. And there's a dirty fingerprint on that, you know, which is an obvious like choice that somebody made in the, you know, in the costuming department or whatever. And it's so, that's just so disgusting. And it ties the whole thing together. And really the whole you know, encounter with these people and this quest for Jesse to go get their money back. What about you, Courtney? What did you pick here?
So I actually had a bit of a hard time with this one because I thought there wasn't really like a standout shot necessarily for me. I thought there were some really great reaction shots throughout, like Walt realizing that Gretchen hadn't, you know, told Skylar the truth. There were a couple of really, really good moments where, like, you see Walt's realization and things like that, that I thought was just really well acted. But I went with a scene that happened inside of the Spooge's household. So I went with the one where Jesse is in front of the TV trying to find Mr. Rogers. You know, it's a mm-hmm. lovely day in the neighborhood, just like the mill lady said, right? Yeah. It's going to be a beautiful day, anything but, right? And he looks back at the kid when he realizes there's only the one channel and it's this knife channel. And he puts his hand over his mouth and looks over his shoulder. And the way the little kid mirrors him, I thought it was just like such a beautifully shot moment. It always stands out to me every time I see it. But I liked a lot of what they did in that space with Jesse before the Spooges got there. So like when he first walks in, it's dark. We can't really see what's going on. You can tell that it's in disarray. But then when he starts opening up the blinds and this like green light filters in. So like he's letting the light in, but it's like this weird, sickly green light mm-hmm. that they use to stream in through the house. So I don't know. It's some really striking moments in the scenes with Jesse and the kid, but I had to go with the one where they look at each other and the kid mirrors him.
Yeah, that I don't know where they got that knife infomercial. Did they mention anything about that on the Insider podcast?
Yeah, they did. So Vince Gilligan spoke a little bit about how like that's like an actual show where it's just these two guys selling knives all the time, and it's something that like, you know, he would see on like late night TV and stuff like that. And they actually had to get permission to use that, but it's something that that he was familiar with anyway.
Yeah, if you listen to what they're saying, like there's like 50 knives in that display or something yeah. like that. And he's like, yeah. Don't let it fool you that this is only $10 or whatever, you know, like.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't believe this Bowie knife is this, you know, this cheap.
So, Aaron, we kept you for a long time. Sorry about all of that. What have you been up to over there at Bald Move?
We just finished up Yellow Jackets, mm-hmm. but we're about to disembark on a whole bunch of stuff coming up in June. We've got, I'm drawing a blank. We've got Star Trek Strange New Worlds. We're starting up. We've got in July, I know we got Justified coming back, City Primeval. We've got Foundation Season 2 in July coming back. We've got The Bear, which we really adored season one. It's dropping its entirety on Hulu sometime in the end of June. That's coming up. We're excited about Badass Fest. Every year we do a look 80s, 90s action movie, kind of virtual film festival, to kick off July, the start of the summer, unofficial start of summer. And this year we're doing a live event. Here in our hometown of Cincinnati, we're hosting a live movie event. We're going to watch Total Recall, and then we're going to do a live podcast, and hopefully going to meet a whole bunch of cool people from the Bald Move community. But yeah, if you want to find out any of the stuff we're doing, just go to baldmove.com. We've got all of our podcasts there, of our social medias. But yeah, if you want to attend the live event, this is your way of hearing it. baldmove.com/live to get the your tickets to Total Recall and a Total Recall podcast.
Yeah. You know, thanks for coming out here. And, you know, we had originally wanted to have you guys both back to back in season one, and that didn't work out because of schedules. So our schedule was kind of screwed up and we finally got you in here. And I guess, you know, that, like I said at the beginning, it's Gretchen. Whenever she comes into the story, you can expect to see one of you guys show up, but it's always good to have you.
Yeah, it was fun. It's funny because when you said it's Peekaboo this week, that's one of the few, you know, there's probably several titles that I'd recognize instantly. But Peekaboo, it's like as soon as I saw the word, I knew exactly the episode, the plot with the little kid, all that stuff just came right back. It's a memorable episode. So appreciate you having me on to discuss it.
Yeah. And we'll talk off air, you know, about maybe coming back later on in the series. I know.
Yeah, I would love to.
I know you got some of the, I remember from listening to your podcast, you're one of the people who was actually watching live whenever black and white teasers.
The teddy bear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it never really made a big deal to me, because when I was watching it, I was like literally enthralled binging. You know, I was like watching one and then the next. Yeah. So I never had that time in between to really guess what was going on with those scenes. And you're one of the people that I've heard, you know, that was pretty underwhelmed by the way that played out at the end there.
Yeah, the big reveal of what they were building up in season two kind of landed like a wet fart with me. Even this is a great season of television, the whole 737 down over ABQ part of the storyline still is like something that sticks in my craw.
Yeah.
It's probably super controversial opinion. My co-host Jim doesn't agree with me on it, but yeah, I always thought that was a lot. That was a lot.
Yeah. It's funny because it's the way we react with TV, you know, and the way that, that's all changing at this time, you know, post Lost and different shows like that, where people really got into discussing them online, you know, that sort of happens in real time here with this mystery. And I think that's the general consensus, was that it people were kind of disappointed with what it turned out to actually be, because they had been guessing throughout the entire season of what it might be.
Yeah.
And it didn't turn out that way. So.
Yep. Yep.
Our listeners will be able to hear us get to that real soon. Aaron, once again, thanks for coming on. We'll have you guys back individually, if not, you know, both of you together at some point as we keep going.
We'd love to come back.
All right. Well, yeah. So thanks for being here. Courtney, do you want to tell people how they might be able to find us and what we got going on?
Yeah, sure. So again, I just want to echo Pete's sentiments. Aaron, thanks so much for coming on. It was fun. Those of you who want to contact us or follow us, you can find us on Twitter at BreakingBadGDT, or you can write to us at BreakingBadGDT@gmail.com. For those of you who wish to support our Patreon, you may do so by joining, going to patreon.com/growthkTransformation. So thanks for listening. Join us next week when we'll be talking about Negro y Azul.